This is the Sex and Psychology Podcast, and it's the sex ed you never got in school and won't get anywhere else. I am your host, Dr. Justin Lehmiller. I am a social psychologist and research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and author of the book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life. Human beings have a long and complicated history with masturbation. Well, it wasn't always complicated, but at some point, things got weird. With the rise of several major world religions, masturbation went from something that was pursued without care or consequence to something that was seen as one of the gravest sins you could commit, as in, it might open up a direct portal to hell. But it wasn't just that. A few centuries ago, masturbation started to become this major public health concern, with several prominent physicians calling it a pathway to disease. This led to a number of creative and sometimes very disturbing approaches to getting people to stop pleasuring themselves. In today's show, we're going to explore the rather wacky history of masturbation, which is super timely because we're in the midst of a social media-fueled war on self-pleasure. There are countless influencers out there talking about the supposed negative health effects of masturbation, which goes to show that even today, we still have a very complicated relationship with self-pleasure. I am joined by Dr. Eric Sprankel, an associate professor of clinical psychology and the co-director of the Sexuality Studies Program at Minnesota State University, Mankato. He's also a licensed clinical psychologist and ASEX-certified sex therapist affiliated with the Minnesota Sexual Health Institute. His latest book is titled DIY, The Wonderfully Weird History and Science of Masturbation. This is going to be a fun and fascinating conversation. Stick around, and we're going to jump in right after the break. Mail My Meds is an online service that allows Americans to access prescription and affordable medication delivery services. They allow men experiencing ED to be reviewed for erectile dysfunction medication prescriptions. You can complete your online prescription questionnaire in as little as 3 minutes and get started today. You'll get reviewed by one of their partnering U.S. board-certified physicians and find out if your prescription has been approved in as little as 1 hour. If approved, prescriptions are good for 1 year of refills. All medications are dispensed from USA pharmacies and shipped straight to you in discreet packaging. Mail My Meds offers low pricing and unmatched convenience, and the whole process can be done from the comfort of your own home. To learn more or get started today, visit mailmymeds.com. That's mailmymeds.com. Are you ready to take your career to the next level and become a certified sexuality professional? The Sexual Health Alliance's certification programs are here to empower you. From sex therapists and sex educators to sex coaches and couples therapists, SHA's comprehensive and flexible programs streamline your path to certification. Learn from leading experts in the field and complete all of your necessary certification requirements in a self-paced, flexible online format. Most importantly, you'll gain the knowledge, skills, and credentials you need to excel in your field while connecting with an engaged community of professionals from around the world. Take your next step at Sexual Health Alliance. Visit sexualhealthalliance.com or check the show notes for the link. Hi, Eric, and welcome back to the Sex and Psychology Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining me. So you have a new book out this month that's all about the history and science of masturbation. So my first question for you is, what prompted you to write a book that's all about self-pleasure? What drew you to this topic, and what's the brief story behind the book?
Yeah, the genesis really comes from social media, and it was just random weirdo comments I was getting from people who weren't following me. I don't follow them, so I don't know if they're just, you know, searching masturbation key terms and wanting to become outraged about what they see. But nonetheless, they posted some comments on some of my posts that dealt with masturbation. And what they were saying was pretty outlandish and easily dismissible. Things of like, I was being unethical and irresponsible for talking about how masturbation is normal and it's not this destroyer of bodies or anything like that. But they were saying, oh no, it is a destroyer of bodies and a destroyer of souls and some even a destroyer of civilizations. And so I was like, All right, that's kind of interesting. I think it's bullshit right on the surface, and I can easily dismiss it. I don't think they're right, but let me look into it a little bit closer. And to confirm that they are incorrect and have some scientific backing in that rejection of what they're saying. But also, I wanted just to better understand, like, where is this coming from? I didn't think that they just made it up. They read it someplace, and I wanted to understand better where they read it and why they so easily believed it. And so that's the origin story behind it.
Thanks for sharing that. So I'm curious, I mean, you post about a lot of different topics when it comes to sex and sexuality on your social media accounts. Is masturbation something that seems particularly likely to bring these kinds of negative comments out of the woodwork, or do you get pushback on everything that you post about?
Pretty much everything. And at first, the masturbation stuff was pretty much flying under the radar from controversy. And it wasn't even on my radar to really push from like an advocate, activist kind of stance of like, oh yeah, this is something that we really need to be talking about in our culture because look at all these anti-masturbation crusades that are going on. That wasn't part of my motivation on social media up until I started getting some of these comments that sparked the interest in the book. So it can get a little pushback now, and that's intentional of how I write it. I know how to kind of poke at the people I want to poke at, say the right words, especially those who are really into like the semen retention and no-fap movements, that kind of stuff. I know how to like unearth them and get them out of the woodwork. But prior to this, no, that I would say the masturbation stuff was the least controversial stuff that I was posting.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like being a sex educator on social media, we could do a whole episode just about that and the kinds of interesting comments and things that we encounter. And I don't know, at least in my experience, it's often the things that I never expected to be controversial that are, and somehow it strikes a nerve. And I'm learning as I'm posting stuff, what people feel about a lot of different things when it comes to sex.
Yeah, absolutely. It's wild and surprising. Like you said, like I'll see some like outrage over something and be like, this one? This is the one that
really?
You didn't see what I posted last week? Because I thought that was actually going to be the one that was going to upset you more. But yeah, who knows?
Yeah, it's an interesting world. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the history of masturbation. In your book, you write that for most of human history, people masturbated without care or consequence. But at some point, that changed. And masturbation started to be viewed through the lens of sin and pathology. So let's talk about some of the turning points, and we'll begin with the sin narrative. So where does the idea of masturbation as a sinful or immoral activity originate? And is this something that's present in most major religious traditions, or is it only in some of them?
Yeah, so the sin part was, you know, obviously, I'm not a theologian, so it's not like I have a huge academic background in this area, which is fortunate because the condemnation of masturbation, at least from Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, those are the ones I focused on specifically, and I broke up Christianity into a couple of different sects like Catholicism and Mormonism. But they all essentially say the same thing when it comes to masturbation, and in particular that masturbation really isn't treated that much differently than a whole host of other sexual behaviors that they frown upon. Occasionally, they'll focus on it because it is viewed as the most accessible. It's the solitary vice, and so somebody can engage in it at any time, and so it could be the sin that is engaged in most frequently and easiest, and so once in a while, it'll get its own special attention because of that. But otherwise, it is no different than having sex outside of marriage, same-sex sexual behavior. Anything that doesn't fit into the narrow definition of what they think is the God-given purpose for our genitals, which within those three major religions is to express marital love with the hopes of procreating with your spouse. Any sexual behavior that's outside of that definition, which is pretty much all of the sexual behaviors, when it includes masturbation, that's how it gets labeled a sin.
Yeah. So across a lot of the dominant religions throughout history and even today, there is this deeply rooted idea of masturbation as sinful. And I think, as you rightly point out, it's often lumped in the same category as anything that might be construed as, say, spilling your seed, as some like to say, right? Where it was a way of engaging in sexual pleasure without the purpose of procreation. So in that way, you know, it wasn't really necessarily unique compared to some of those other behaviors. But yeah, you know, if it was something you could do by yourself and you didn't need a partner, yeah, it was the most frequently engaged sin you could potentially engage in.
Yeah, right. Right. Absolutely. And it also kind of goes against a lot of values that these major religions have, especially as it relates to sexuality and bodily autonomy, because it is such an individual behavior. It's something that we can do by ourselves. And that's frowned upon because any type of sexual behavior at least needs to be engaged with a partner. And how dare you just express your own sexuality alone?
Right. Now, aside from telling people that they're going to be spiritually damned if they touch themselves, yeah, what are some of the other ways that religious leaders tried to dissuade people from masturbating over the years? So, for example, you talk in your book about how some have said that you shouldn't ever even touch your penis, even when you urinate, right? To avoid any potential temptation. So what are some, let's say, ordained ways of masturbatory avoidance?
Yeah, the not touching yourself during urination came from the Talmud and the interpretations of the story of Onan from the book of Genesis, right? The spill your seed story. And like what we were kind of alluding to earlier, it's not an explicit condemnation of masturbation. It's essentially don't waste an ejaculation because ejaculation is for procreation. And so that includes a lot of sexual behaviors, masturbation just being one of them. And so in the Talmud, there is these rabbis debating that story and arguing of like, how can we apply that do not spill your seed into like everyday life? And they recognize, well, in order to not accidentally spill seed, we shouldn't become accidentally aroused. And how do we become accidentally aroused? It's like, well, touching our genitals in some way. And so they created all these rules about, at least how to be mindful about not having an accidental wasting of a seed. And yeah, one rabbi suggested you shouldn't even hold your penis during urination, because if you hold it, it may become a little arousing. And if it's aroused, and then you're more likely to ejaculate. Other people thought that other rabbis in the Talmud argued that in the morning, to make sure that you didn't have a nocturnal emission, an accidental ejaculation overnight, that you need to inspect your genitals. But that came with a risk, because inspecting your genitals could be arousing in and of itself and ironically lead to an ejaculation that you're trying to examine for in the first place. And so you should make it as uncomfortable as possible and use like a harsh rag or even a rock to examine your genitals. And so unless you're aroused by that type of stimulation, more likely that was going to be uncomfortable and not lead to an accidental emission. So those were some of the things, at least within Judaism. What was interesting to me is that there was the obvious, like, you're opening portals to hell and demons are going to attach to you. And some of this mythology around demons and a lot of satanic stuff that the pastors and priests were talking about. But what was interesting is that oftentimes that wasn't enough. A scare tactic of hellfire, eternity in hell and burning and suffering, which you would think that would be an easy sell of like, okay, yeah, don't want to go there. So what do I need to do not to go there? Don't touch my penis, not touch my clitoris. Okay, fine, I can do that. But that's such an abstract concept of like hell and even eternity. We can't grasp what that actually is. And so even the pastors and the priests have to rely on medical pseudoscience to try to convince their congregations not to touch themselves. And that's when you start seeing clergy start talking about negative health effects of masturbation, because their spiritual scare tactics aren't doing enough of the job.
Yeah, portals to hell. I mean, I'm just stuck on that. If you touch yourself, you're going to open up a portal to hell. But one of the other things I remember you talking about in your book was, I believe this was also in the Mormon tradition, of sleeping while holding the Book of Mormon in arms as a way of preventing you from touching yourself, right?
Right. Yeah. Like all these opportunity costs of like, well, if you're doing this with your hands, then obviously you can't masturbate, at least with your hands. There's other ways to masturbate. And people have gotten creative. And we saw that too, historically, of when children were sleeping with, and their parents had their hands like bound to prevent nighttime masturbation. It's like, well, horny enough and creative kids just found a way to roll over and like dry hump the mattress. And so like hand binding didn't really do the trick. But nonetheless, did try to prevent any type of direct hand genital contact by, okay, keep your hands busy, right? No idle hands. That kind of gets into a devil thing as well. So holding the Book of Mormon, making sure that you're exercising, like lifting weights. And so your hands are holding barbells, holding the rosary, and getting into all these like essential competing behaviors, things that like a very basic behavioral intervention that we think of like tobacco cessation of like, oh, what? How can you keep your hands and your mouth occupied so it's you don't have a cigarette in your fingers or in between your lips? It's the same strategy, simple behaviorism. Yeah, and so that's why you see a lot of these anti-masturbation religious folks go into pretty extreme and extensive kind of behavioral plans for themselves of essentially how to keep themselves busy and occupied. Because any time that they think that they have alone time and downtime, that's a risk factor for them. And so they're compulsively going to the gym, they're compulsively praying, they're going to church, they're doing all these things in which masturbating within those environments could be done, maybe inappropriately, but it reduces the likelihood of that happening.
Yeah. So the masturbation as sin narrative is a big part of the story here, but there's also this parallel narrative of masturbation as an unhealthy practice that promotes disease. And as you said, a lot of the religious leaders would kind of lean on some of these health arguments as ways of discouraging masturbation. But when did this idea of masturbation as disease, when did it become a public health concern? And what was the reasoning behind why it was bad for you?
So it kind of seems that everything pointed to the early 1700s in London, in which there is a pamphlet called Onania. And that was based on the story of Onan. So Onania was the name of this pamphlet. It was anonymous. There's some speculation of who actually could write it. I didn't get into the weeds of kind of that. I just wanted to mention Onania in the intro of the book as kind of like this starting point of essentially selling a disease now, right? Because up to that point, masturbation, for most people, they didn't really care about it. They didn't think twice. At most, it was kind of contextualize as a sinful behavior and spiritual consequences that could come from that if one believed in it. But otherwise, people didn't pay much mind to it until Onania started circling. And it was essentially like the WebMD out on the street, in the sense that if you felt like you had a certain ailment, you could see that in Onania, that ailment was mentioned and the cause, according to the author of Onania, was, oh, you masturbated. That's why you're feeling this way, right? So I could only imagine it fueled massive hypochondriasis throughout London of like everything that you think that you're feeling, you have, and here's the cause, even though that's not actually the cause of what you're feeling if you are actually experiencing something. So that was being sold as a disease for the first time, and people really bought it up. And I think why people bought it up, it just kind of hit at the perfect time of there was this kind of emerging health hygiene kind of movement that was going on in parts of Europe and even in the United States a little bit later, of kind of focusing on individual health behaviors and how that impacts clinical diseases. And so that was fitting into that narrative of like, oh, you have X, Y, and Z. Let's understand where X, Y, and Z is coming from. And they just filled in the blanks with it's coming from your sexual behavior and primarily your solo sexual behavior. And it also fit in well because this was during the emerging of one of London's first mass market booksellers. And so they had a way to distribute these ridiculous ideas to a large part of London's population. And why does this work? It's because there is still that underlying taboo that we still have today in our culture, that there's something about masturbation that may be unhealthy. It may be immoral. It may be wrong. People have these doubts because we're just not explicitly taught otherwise, typically growing up. And so we're left with filling in the narrative, filling in the blanks with, well, what does masturbation do to me? What does it do to my body? And now you come across this pamphlet, which you've never seen before, and it says that, oh, masturbation is causing blindness and it's causing pimples and it's causing all these problems to essentially every bodily system. Yeah, that's going to be landing pretty well for somebody who has already a certain degree of masturbation insecurity and anxiety.
Yeah, you know, we talk a lot today about how easy it is for misinformation to spread. But if you think historically, it was really easy for misinformation to spread when you didn't have any other way to kind of check your sources or find other sorts of information out. And so I think it's always been a problem, you know, this idea of misinformation, especially around sexuality related issues. Today, at least, you know, if you're online, you can go and you can find different sources that say different things and you can do your research more easily. But back then, you know, it is super easy to see how these ideas could spread like wildfire if there was nothing out there to really challenge them. And I think it would be really hard to get information out there at that time that could challenge what people said. You know, things at that period were often just taken on the basis of authority. You know, if it was mm-hmm. published in a book or if somebody in a position of power said it, you just took it to be that that was the truth, because what else could you think otherwise? You know, there wasn't really a way to get competing information in those days.
Yeah, definitely early 1700s London, there wasn't a Betty Dotson of that time, right? A masturbation pioneer and liberator and activist who could counter the narrative that's within Onania. Londoners were just left with Onania.
Yeah. Now, the people who said masturbation is unhealthy, just like the religious leaders who said it was sinful, went to great lengths to discourage people from engaging in self-pleasure, or as you mentioned in your book, some people called it self-pollution. You know, they had other terms right. for it at that point in time. So what were some of the other practices or ideas they promoted in order to encourage people to stop masturbating?
Well, the scare tactics was essentially similar to the main focus of Onania, and that's just attributing all these different health concerns to the behavior that you're not supposed to be engaging in, right? And so it's taking masturbation and saying, if you masturbate, this is what you can expect your body to do as a result, and it's going to be horrific. And some of these people went into like very, very graphic detail. It wasn't just saying that, oh, you're going to have like kind of wrinkly skin as a result. They went into like pretty in-depth detail, graphic detail of how your body is essentially going to decompose on itself and you're going to lead yourself into an early death simply by having a self-induced orgasm. And so they relied on those scare tactics. And some of them did have medical training and some were physicians, people like John Kellogg and Benjamin Rush. These were physicians, respected physicians of their time, and still had some influence even today, especially for Benjamin Rush. There's medical systems in Chicago named after him, one of the American founders of psychiatry. But when it came to their views of sex, and particularly masturbation, they were still influenced by their religious and moral beliefs about it and their opposition to that. But they just had the medical language now to talk about what would typically up to that point just be viewed as a moral or a spiritual behavior. And now they're taking that moral or spiritual behavior and saying that it is physically harmful for you. And this is why. And there is an authority effect with that. He has doctor in front of his name. He must know what he's talking about when he's talking about that masturbation can cause psychosis, can cause uterine displacement, and all these things that are in these books that were attributed to the solitary vice or self-pollution or self-abuse, all these different names that they had for it. So that was the big thing of just relying on authority and kind of medical jargon, because even those without a medical background, someone like Reverend Sylvester Graham, who was in the early 1800s, no medical training whatsoever. He was a pastor in New England, but he would read medical books on the side as a hobby and at least have enough medical jargon that it seemed legit in his book. And one book that he wrote was like a lecture on chastity to young men. And in it, it's just ridiculous. He's talking about masturbation causing discharges from the anus. And it's just like, where is he getting this? It's like, it's fan fiction, and kind of start have to wonder, like, what kind of experience did he have masturbating and how was he masturbating if he thinks this is the cause effect for this very simple, pretty much non-consequential behavior. So yeah, kind of relying on medical jargon at the time. And I think that was a big buy-in for the general public who didn't have any access to medical information prior to that, because it was only privileged information to some.
Yeah, I mean, good question. I mean, if this was happening to you while you were masturbating, what were you doing, buddy?
Right.
Yeah. So many of the historical approaches to curbing masturbation just seem downright bonkers by today's standards. I mean, if masturbation really opened portals to hell and your body started decomposing, I would look out my window right now and it would look like The Walking Dead outside. Right,
right.
We know that most people are masturbating and they're doing it frequently and all these other sorts of things, right? Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways, it seems like today we know better when it comes to some of these beliefs. But we also don't, you know,
right.
we can't have nice things. Masturbation right. continues to be a source of controversy, even in the modern world. And I mean, if you just look at the outcry that happened in the 1990s, when U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Jocelyn Elders suggested that perhaps masturbation should be a part of sex ed, that was a seemingly innocuous comment, but it got her fired. Mm-hmm. Now, some of my younger listeners might not be familiar with Dr. Elders, so can you tell us a little bit more about the story there and how that reaction to her comment is very telling of how this legacy of masturbation as immoral and unhealthy just has not gone away.
Yeah, and you make a good point to start off with that first, of that it's easy to dismiss a lot of the quackery and the hucksterism that's in the book, mainly for like comic relief of like, yeah, we know that masturbation doesn't cause uterine displacement and discharges from the anus and tooth loss, right? We know better than that. We can just kind of laugh at those assertions. And that can even get into, it's like, well, what's even the point of the book then? Like, I think we're all past that. And it's like, no, we're not past that by a long shot. There is still a lot of anxiety and insecurities surrounding masturbation, particularly with how much is too much, what's the role of pornography in masturbation and the impacts of pornography. There's all these things about porn causes brain damage. But when we talk about porn, we're actually talking about masturbation. And so porn is just the easy kind of like material scapegoat, but it's actually a porn conversation. So in like vibrators causing desensitized clitorises. So there's still a lot of masturbation anxiety. So back in the 90s, getting to your specific question with Jocelyn Elder, she was the U.S. Surgeon General under President Clinton at the time. She was at some type of conference with the U.N. and an AIDS-related conference. And she got a question from the audience that essentially asked, what do you think should be the role of masturbation in sex ed? And so her off-the-cuff kind of response was something like, yeah, it's a normal behavior and I could see it being part of curriculum, but we were not even teaching the basics and maybe we should start with that. You know, I'm paraphrasing. So it was something like that. Decent enough for being off the cuff. She didn't say like, no, that's inappropriate. And she didn't say like, absolutely, masturbation needs to be in K-12 sex ed. It was just an acknowledgement of like, yeah, it's normal, but we're not even doing the bare minimum. So let's maybe start with that. And yeah, that started the firestorm, and not really started it, but that was the last straw with her tenure under the Clinton administration. Huge outcry over that, you know, Elders is promoting masturbation to children and all these things, all, you know, similar tactics that you see now of like something that's pretty benign, that gets taken very much out of context, exploding up to something that it wasn't actually said, because the opposition, it's an easy target for them to make as a little pet issue for them for that week. So Clinton didn't want to deal with any of the backlash. She didn't want to stand up for Elders and ask for her resignation, which she did. And a little bit, and why I said this was a little bit of a last straw and really didn't cause or start the controversy with her, and that she's been outspoken in a lot of different sexual health and progressive areas before, of talking about harm reduction strategies for sex workers, being very reproductive choice, to the point of even critiquing Catholic clergy and their, quote, love affair with the fetus, and starting to challenge some of that. So she was already ruffling feathers on Capitol Hill. And so this was just kind of the breaking point, I think, for the Clinton administration of wanting to distance themselves from somebody who was sexually progressive. And of course, we know the rest of Clinton's story, not really the beacon of sexual ethics himself. But she got thrown under the bus.
Yeah, it's such an interesting story. And it is very telling of just how controversial masturbation is, because that was the thing that did her in, you know, in terms of all of these other policies and positions that she advocated with respect to sexual and reproductive health. It was masturbation that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And right. I think what you mentioned also about how there's kind of this, but what about the children? But won't anybody think of the kids as, you know, a big part of the anti-masturbation narrative? People freak out about the idea that their kids might masturbate, and they don't know what to do about it. They don't know how to talk to them about it. And so it's just something that is discouraged. And then that leads kids to feel like this is a shameful thing. And then they grow up carrying that belief with them. And then masturbation becomes that sort of perpetual source of anxiety. And so, you know, parents are actually doing a big part of instilling that masturbatory anxiety in their kids by just never even broaching the subject of it with them, or by punishing their kids when masturbation happens, or embarrassing them, or something else that makes them feel bad about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is definitely a minefield for sex educators to go down, to talk about anything relating to sexuality and childhood, advocating for, you know, K-12 sex ed. Can't count the number of times I've been called a groomer for suggesting something like pretty basic of just that, oh yeah, fifth graders should understand and know the parts of their body. That's it. And, you know, you get the weirdos coming in and calling me a groomer and a pedo and everything like that. I'd be like, all right, this is where we are right now. Great. But yeah, like what you were saying, that this does get passed down through the generations, through silent families. And there's a lot of mechanisms that kind of play into why parents don't openly talk about masturbation with their children, is because they grew up in a silent family household too, and they never got these talks and they don't know what to do. They have a certain level of masturbatory anxiety for themselves, not knowing what's healthy, what's normal, especially at a particular developmental level. So they're just ill-equipped to deal with it. And so that's why there's calls for, hey, you know, there are professionally trained sex educators that could take this burden off of you and provide this information. And then we're like, no, 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 we don't need that in schools. That's the job for the parents at the home. Be like, well, the parents at the home aren't doing that, so you can't have it both ways. So like, pick one.
Right.
Let's run with it. Yeah. And so the chapter one deals with childhood developmental sexuality and where masturbation falls into that. And it falls into from the moment of, you know, even in utero masturbation, there's ultrasound evidence of fetuses masturbating and how that's different, obviously, than masturbation that occurs during infancy and toddlerhood and then early and later childhood and teenage years and adulthood. It's all different. It's all kind of the responding to their developmental level, their physical environment, what the motivation and the function of masturbation is, that all changes for us over time. From the outside, it looks like, oh, this just is masturbation, maybe used a slightly different depending on their level, whether they're more reliant on like a couch cushion than their hand or something. But generally, it's like genital stimulation. But it's the motivation, it's the desire, the drive, the function of the behavior that will change developmentally. And I think that's what people who are really opposed to K through 12 sex ed forget about, and that they're projecting what sexuality means for them as an adult onto a fifth grader and think it means the exact same thing for a fifth grader. And that's what's being taught in schools. It's like,
right. No,
the sexual world of a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old is completely different than that of a 31-year-old. And that's what's being taught, is what's relevant to that 10 or 11-year-old, not what's relevant to the 31-year-old.
Yeah. And we could do a whole other episode just on sex education and like what should and shouldn't be taught and some of the benefits of it and how to make age appropriate sex ed. And, you know, even something as basic as just teaching people the proper terms for their genital anatomy, that has value in a lot of ways in terms of them understanding their own body, but also in terms of if somebody were to perpetrate sexual assault on them or something, they're better able to report what happened because they know what their own body parts are. And so, you know, teaching people anatomy, teaching people about boundaries, these other sorts of things, like that usually can't start too early, right? And it's about doing something that's age appropriate, giving people the tools and skills they need so that as they grow up, they're going to be able to communicate about these things.
Right. And I think there are a lot of bad actors who are opposed to K through 12 sex ed, who are just using it. They understand what it is, but they're using it as kind of a wedge issue and to kind of make some ridiculous claims of like, oh, the left are groomers, they're pedos and things like that, but they know better. I did have one conversation with a guy because I really wanted to understand, where is this coming from? He, out of the gate, he called me a groomer. And I was like, what about this suggests grooming? And I had a pretty lengthy back and forth with him trying to understand from his perspective, where is this coming from? For him, at least, it was a conflation of sex coaching and sex education. He thought that sex educators in the schools were actually demonstrating sexual behavior, demonstrating on the children. Like, I don't know where you got that from, but that's more concerning that that's where your mind went, that's what sex ed is. But okay, I could understand if you had that belief why you would be opposed to that, because that should be opposed. But that's actually not what sex education is. So at least for that person, there was just ignorance about what sex ed is. But I don't want to give everybody the benefit of the doubt, because I know there's bad actors out there who do know what sex ed is, but are still vehemently opposed to it for their own political gain.
So much of what people might say about sex or sex education, you know, is a misconception. You know, it's not rooted in reality. It's based on some scenario they've conjured up in their head. Maybe it was influenced by something they heard or read at some point. But yeah, the myth versus reality is very different when it comes to sex ed. Now, we're going to talk much more about this in the next episode, but it seems like the new frontier for the anti-masturbation movement these days is on social media. And you alluded to this in terms of what the origin for the book was. So can you just tell us a little bit more about how the rise of social media has coincided with the rise in negative views about masturbation? And is that because social media is sort of becoming kind of this default source of sex ed because it's not being taught in the schools and we're not learning about it from our parents?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a part of this, so that it fills a gap that it's not being filled otherwise in education, formal education. And I think, too, that kind of similar to why Onania really stuck in the early 1700s was that we're already, you know, because of silent families, we don't get the information about masturbation, that it's okay, that it's normal to be curious about your body. It's not going to hurt you in any physical way, that we have still insecurity and anxiety about that. So if we come across a Reddit that says it is harmful, then it's like, oh yeah, I kind of suspected a little bit that it may be harmful. Tell me more about that. And now whoever this author is for this subreddit is now your go-to guy for masturbation information. And it's not accurate. And I used to have a view that social media was a net positive, that all the bullshit that's out there on social media, whatever, but it can make you feel less alone. If you're a little bit of a weirdo yourself, you realize, oh, there's a lot of weirdos out there, just like me, right? And that's a good thing. And you can communicate with them. If you don't have much of a social network in real life, wherever you live, you can find one online and that can just be as valuable. So that's good. And that's how I always thought it was a net positive. However, you know, over the past couple of years, it's been a struggle to maintain that optimism that it is a net positive. I'm starting to view it more as a net negative. And even for the same reasons why I thought it was a net positive at the beginning, because I thought it was a good thing that we were elevating all voices up onto the same playing field and that we all have this like equal chance on the same platform, right? How that has been a negative, especially for sexual health, and I'm assuming for a whole host of other fields too, we saw this all during the pandemic as well, is that somebody with no expertise, no credentials, no area of knowledge within a particular subject area is speaking as if they do have that area of knowledge and expertise. And they are essentially going up against people that do have that knowledge and that credentialed background to be speaking authoritatively on these topics and essentially just dismiss it as, well, that's your opinion, I can have mine. It's like, this isn't about a matter of opinion, right? No. We're not debating our favorite horror movie from 2023. We're dealing with actual facts that do have concrete answers. And I think that's the big issue that at least I see, in my opinion, from social media kind of driving this misinformation and sometimes even disinformation, because people are just speaking. And as long as they have good communication skills and can sell it, it's going to be believable to a large segment of the population. And then that's how you have misinformation being interpreted as fact. And when you have the actual experts, the scientists, the scholars saying, wait, that's not actually accurate, you're labeled a shill for whatever industry that they think that you're being paid off to say this information.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, as a social psychologist, there's so much social psychology in terms of how the anti-masturbation movement has been sold to people across centuries, right? Mm-hmm. And often it's come with those appeals from authority. You know, we have a tendency to take what authoritative figures say to be fact or truthful. But also in the modern era, I think people also rely on a lot of heuristics to determine authority on social media, where you look at what is their follower count or did they appear in this media outlet or that one? And then, you know, just because they have those things that signify popularity, then somehow any bonkers statement that they say gets taken as a statement of fact. And it's like, no, like, why are you listening to this person just because they have a lot of followers instead of listening to a scientist or somebody who's actually studied this for years, right? It's Yeah, I know.
It's a lot of, a lot of media illiteracy and scientific illiteracy at play. Because you see that too, like, buying into just a large account, got the blue check mark and everything, maybe you have doctor in front of their name, but then you look at it closer and it's like, their doctorate came from a certificate program of a certified brain coach. And it's like, well, what the hell is a certified brain coach?
And you look
into and you look into that, and it's coming from this place called Amen University, and you can buy it for like $999. It's like, okay, so it's a smoke and mirror show of credentials and expertise, but they know how to sell it. And that's kind of like I would say the misinformation around masturbation online can't be fully explained by grift, but there are definitely the grifters out there who know that they are peddling in misinformation. They are selling anxiety and they're selling the cure by through like abstinence or one-on-one coaching programs and stuff to abstain better or whatever. There is that grift element too, and they do it very well.
Yep. They do, unfortunately. Yeah. And we will have much more to say about that in the next episode. So thanks for sharing the fascinating history of masturbation with us, Eric. I look forward to speaking further about this.
My pleasure.
So thank you so much for this amazing conversation, Eric. It was a pleasure to have you here. Can you please tell my listeners where they can go to learn more about you and your work and get a copy of your new book titled DIY?
Yeah, sure. I'm on social media. I'm on, let's see, Instagram, Threads, and Twitter, all at Dr. Sprenkel. My website, drsprenkel.com. You'll see all the links to get the book DIY. Two links typically. One's just to the Amazon one. If you don't want to shop at Amazon, it's another independent booksellers too. Just search for it there. And then also I have a link to Next Chapter Booksellers here in St. Paul in Minnesota. They're the exclusive provider for signed copies that they can ship out anywhere in the U.S. So if you want a signed copy, go to the Next Chapter Booksellers, their site. Otherwise, wherever you buy books, it'll be there.
Great. And I'll be sure to include links to your website and social media handles in the show notes. Thanks again so much for your time. I really appreciate having you here.
Thanks, Justin.
Thank you for listening. To keep up with new episodes of this podcast, visit my website, Sex and Psychology, at sexandpsychology.com, or subscribe on your favorite platform, where I hope you'll take a moment to rate and review the show. You can also follow me on the socials for daily sex research updates. I'm on Twitter and TikTok at Justin Lehmiller and Instagram at Justin J. Lehmiller. Also, be sure to check out my book, Tell Me What You Want. And if you have a question you'd like me to answer on a future episode of this show, you can leave me a podcast voicemail at speakpipe.com/sexandpsychology. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.